Pokrovsk is literally hanging by its fingernails. Almost nothing is left of the city in Ukraine hands. Just a few outskirts still have some stragglers hanging on the end of it. And yet, we have in the West and we have in Kiev just complete self-delusion and unwillingness to acknowledge what's happening right before their eyes. I continue to see comments from so many different people in all different quarters just ignoring what their eyes are telling them and saying, well, with the reports you have, they're just not true. No, actually, things are okay. It's hard to even imagine at this point, especially in this fight, that that's where we are. And yet, I can't say anything different than what these people are saying. And we're reporting and talking about it and what that's actually going to mean for Ukraine and for the Ukrainians. And to try and make some sense of the unsensible, we have Larry Johnson back with his former CIA intel analyst, author at sonar21.com and son of the New American. What was that? He got off too fast there, Gary. Son of the New American Revolution on Substack.com. And of course, always the famous Larry the Shirt Johnson. Larry, welcome back as always.
Senor, good to always be with you, Danny.
You know, we talk about this kind of stuff, unfortunately, a lot because there's a lot of examples and we've got some new ones to share today. But Larry, I just got to ask, and maybe this is a rhetorical question that the answer is unfortunately self-evident. Is there ever an end to this to where we will finally acknowledge reality or are we doomed to just being like Baghdad Bob and just saying there's no Americans in Baghdad until the tanks roll around the corner?
When the Americans are finally paraded before a camera, then at that point it will become real. But until then, hey, I said to someone else yesterday, the situation we're in is when you try to objectively report what's going on, it's either that's not happening or you're just spreading Russian disinformation. So we're at the stage now, if I say, the sun rises in the east. Well, that's Russian disinformation. Most dogs have four legs. That's Russian disinformation. So, you know, and that headline that was up that the Russia nears first victory in 2 years. Were these people not paying attention last year with respect to Avdiivka? And then the year before that, Bakhmut. And the year before that, Mariupol. Now, the significance of that is that in 2022, 2023, 2024, Russia had one, if you call one major sustained battle that they eventually won. This year, we got at least five or six of them going on simultaneously. And Russia is doing well in every single one of them. Ukraine is really nearing the point of collapsing the front line, whatever passes for the front line in Ukraine, going from Kharkiv in the north through Donbass down to Zaporizhia in the south. And what most Americans don't appreciate, the distance we're talking about is like the distance from, say, Baltimore, Maryland, all the way to Miami.
Okay? Oh, wow. Yeah, that's when you put it like that kind of context, it's like, yo, that's a long way.
So if I give you 700,000 troops, which sounds like a lot, spread out over that 1,100 miles, that's nothing. And that's the real problem Ukraine now faces. They don't have the reserves in depth to be able to fortify that whole line, and Russia does. And so Russia is now just pushing.
Yeah, and let me just kind of show that. We zoomed in here on Pokrovsk, which we'll get back to in a minute, but just kind of to really reinforce what you're talking about there. This is this whole huge line from Odessa. You can kind of go down to Odessa and then through Kherson and all the way through Zaporizhia up into Donetsk and Luhansk, et cetera, all the way up to the top. And now then, you know, even into the Kharkiv Oblast. There's been additional incursions from the Russians in the Kharkiv Oblast as well. The Dnipropetrovsk, which you mentioned, I think, last time you were on the show, et cetera, down here. And obviously in Pokrovsk, in the Liman area, the Kupiansk, and several others. So, I mean, it's just pick your poison. I mean, how can we look at this and say, well, this is just not success on the Russian side because it hasn't been very fast, I guess.
Yeah, it's Maryland, Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, and 2/3 of Florida. That's a big piece of real estate. And, you know, I am fascinated, and maybe you have some insight on this. Why is it that in the West, we've got this imaginary game clock running down? Boy, Russia's moving real slow. It's like, it's the fourth quarter of the Super Bowl. 2 minutes are left to go. And if Russia doesn't score in the next 2 minutes, they lose. It's like, wait a second. They're under no time pressure. It's not like there's a clock ticking down.
Well, and I think, Larry, that that's a really important thing to point out here, because you do have very, very different clocks. You have the Americans. I think your analogy is brilliant. It's not just, you know, four quarters and now we're in the final 2 minutes in our impression, because, I mean, the war's been going on nearly 4 years, so it must be an end of the fourth quarter, right? So there's got to be only 2 minutes left. But it's like Russia, and this is not a perfect analogy because of, you know, for obvious reasons on the Russians, but it's like they're playing baseball or chess, maybe is a better one. There's no clock. You just have the next move, and they're operating on a completely different psychological clock on the Russian side. And I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about, because you've got some visibility on both sides and both mentalities. How do you see the two playing out? And let's even start from the Russian side.
Yeah. So from the Russian side at the outset, and what I heard, you know, as we talked about General Abdi Aludinov and General Brzezinski and Colonel Basarino, you know, people I met in Moscow over the last, you know, couple of weeks back. The only real interference, if you want to call it interference or intervention by Vladimir Putin with respect to military operations early in the war was, let's minimize the casualties. We're under no rush. We're going to stop this threat, but we don't need to unduly put our men at risk. And the other aspect to it as well is that Russian senior officers, they actually do lead from the front. I mean, Aludinov, he didn't tell those guys to go into that pipeline, that 13-kilometer walk through a gas pipeline up into Sucha. He didn't say, okay, guys, get going. That's your job. He led the thing. He led it, right, you know, hunched over marching for 13 kilometers, you know. I have a tough time hunched over walking from my bed to the bathroom. Okay. So that's pretty remarkable. But the other point that was made to me was, look, we're trying to actually minimize the number of Ukrainians we're killing because of relatives. The number of Russians who are married to Ukrainians and vice versa is significant. And you've got family members on both sides. I mean, hell, General Sursky, the Ukrainian commander, his parents live in Russia. So there's sort of a civil war element to this that they don't want to destroy unnecessarily the lives of the Ukrainians, and they want to preserve the lives of the Russians. So, you know, they're moving along at, you know, as some in the West want to say, at a snail's pace. So what? I mean, it's not like they're being scored on, you know, how quick they did it. And you know, baseball, actually, I think cricket is probably a better example because that's even slower than baseball. That goes on for days. But
it's probably a better one. That's probably a really good one there. By the way, I want to kind of break in here. Gary just sent up, we have some breaking news. Angelina Jolie's driver has been detained and drafted into the army, the Ukrainian army, during her trip into Ukraine. And you know, she was actually there. I remember seeing something about this yesterday, that she was there and kind of on a humanitarian mission. And I was thinking, you know, this is not really helping that much because, I mean, a lot of people are aware things are bad. But, you know, she was there. She was on the pro-Ukraine side. But now then apparently her driver has been drafted. I mean, what does that tell you about the just desperation, I guess, on the Ukraine side, that they're literally any man that's breathing?
Yeah, the next time get a female driver and make sure it's a woman over the age of 50. So, I mean, yeah, look, as you know, I saw your conversation with Doug McGregor, and actually I just talked to him a little bit ago, and he was pointing out, he says, look, some of the guys that the Russians have captured in around Pokrovsk, they literally put on a uniform about a week or two ago. You know, they probably learned how to zip up the fly on the pants, but beyond that, they're nowhere near equipped to be a functioning soldier. So this is reminiscent of what the Austrian corporal did back in Berlin in April of 1945, where young boys and older men were being, you know, they're given uniforms and a Panzerfaust, you know, an anti-tank weapon, and stuck out in the rubble. It was a last-ditch stand, and it wasn't going to change anything tactically or strategically on the battleground.
And speaking of the battleground, let's run to take a look at that here, because the issue at stake right now is the Pokrovsk area. And as we've been talking about, and now you can see graphically, there are only three areas inside of Pokrovsk left where the Ukrainians are in complete control, and then a couple of gray zones around here where it's not yet fully in the Russian hands. Virtually all the rest is in Russian hands, and they're doing mop-up operations from what I've read this morning here. They have basically and now effectively closed the gap between the northern thrust and the southern thrust up through here, and now then you have this whole area of Mirnograd and all the troops that are defending down in this area all effectively surrounded. So I'm not sure what anybody thinks is going to happen here. Now, the Ukraine side is still trying to conduct operations up in here to try to break through, but they haven't been able to do so in the last few days, and it doesn't look to me like they're going to have enough strength to break all the way through to open this back up here. And if it needs to, Russia does appear to have the troops that they could rush in, so to prevent that from happening. And when you take a look at, and Gary found this video this morning from some of the Ukrainian soldiers that have been captured recently, and, well, it's not a very pretty sight. We're not using the audio here, by the way, for various reasons. But you're stating the task was not explained to us. Well, at the position, they did not explain what our task was. I'm looking and why was surrendered. We learned that we were surrounded. They didn't drop us any water or food. I'm sick of everything. There was no way out. The shelling was intense. And when we realized that no one would evacuate us or save us, we decided to surrender. And then the Russian asked, what advice would you give them to your comrades? And he said, don't die. Surrender when possible. It's just really heartbreaking to see. And really, that kind of puts a graphic image on what you literally just described about what Hitler was doing in the last phases of that war by throwing these guys in there. And they're, I mean, does that look like somebody that you're going to, like, thrust the Russians back with?
Yeah, you didn't see any young studs there. these were old guys like me, And it's the other aspect, though, is it appears that there are. I think it's CIA Special Activities Division personnel that are trapped both in Pokrovsk and up in Kupiansk. That's why you had that operation the other day where they made two attempts. First with one Black Hawk helicopter, the other with two, to quote, insert, you know, GUR special forces into the area. You know, the public story was, oh, they're going there to try to strengthen the defense and, you know, help beat back the Russians. That's not what special operations forces do. They're not, you know, they make very little difference in a conventional war. And this is, I'll call this an unconventional war. It's unconventional because of the presence of drones, the immediacy of intelligence, reconnaissance, surveillance. But you know, they were clearly trying to evacuate people out, and it didn't pull it off.
Well, you know, let me ask you about that, because I've seen the video like everybody else has, and I'm thinking, okay. I don't even see how they would have had a theoretical possibility to get anybody out. I mean, they dropped him off on the edge. It was, I think, 11 guys, at least in that one video that was seen. There were two other Blackhawks. Maybe they had also had 10 or 11. you can insert those guys in there, but to do what? I mean, guys on foot are not going to be able to get anybody else out there unless you bring another empty helicopter in to bring them out.
Well, I,
what
I,
do you
I,
think about that?
Yeah, no, I think the plan was that they were going to infiltrate in, collect the people, and then provide an escort for them out to an LZ, a rendezvous point. And they didn't even get that far. They hadn't even figured out that they'd be immediately tracked with these drones. And the reason I say it's luckily CIA, because GUR, you know, Budinov was, you know, they're saying he was in charge of the operation. Man, Budinov has been, you know, wedded at the hip with the CIA from the outset. I mean, this relationship between the GUR and CIA goes back more than 11 years in terms of an intense relationship. So this wasn't a military, this was nothing under Sirsky. Because it's under Budinov, that tells you right away, this is a CIA operation and a joint, let's call it a joint CIA-GUR operation. And so the, again, those guys, they weren't going into fight, but they were taking them in the hopes that they'd be able to help escort the others out instead of letting, you know, the two, three or four, you know, how many ever U.S. Americans are trapped inside Pokrovsk, to just put them on their own to figure out, you know, where they'd go to get picked up.
Okay, but let's talk about something here. This is nearly 4 years of war, right? So
yeah,
we have all kinds of experience. We understand everything you literally just mentioned about the surveillance, the pervasive surveillance in the presence of drones, whether it's attack drones or reconnaissance drones, et cetera. Nobody in this part of the earth could possibly think that you're going to insert a UH-60, get guys out, and that there's not going to be drones watching all of them. I mean, what possible hope would anyone who ever ordered this that these guys were going to literally be able to do anything on foot? I mean, seriously, behind the thought?
Let me take you back to your days when you were in the Army and you did exercises. And at the end of the exercise, there'd be the hot wash. And they talked about lessons learned.
Yeah.
Did you ever see any lessons learned?
I saw a lot of stuff that made men on PowerPoint slides. It was really good. We put it in an envelope and really never read it again. But yeah, we had them.
The best exercise ever. You know, this was no one's ever done it better than us. But the I'm basing this, I did it for 23 years. And what I saw repeatedly were things that you think, like you're thinking rationally and logically. They've been doing this for 3.5 years. They should have known by now.
And exactly.
They don't learn. I mean, it's shocking. It really is shocking.
And, I mean, you literally sent probably all those men to their deaths. I doubt any of them survived.
Yeah. Well, go back to World War II and look at the operations of the Special Operations Executive by the British, you know, the SOE. They did that repeatedly. Go back to Vietnam, the operations by SOG, Special Operations Group. They kept sending people out. They kept getting killed. They're trying to figure, geez, what's going on? They, you know, the enemy seems to know where we're moving. No shit. they were penetrated. So what I'm saying, I'm not surprised by this because we got a good long history of it.
I'm sorry, Larry, I got to throw this in there though. My incredulous reaction to this is because I personally observed it done the right way when we went into Desert Storm specifically. Colonel Doug McGregor was the operations officer, the S3 of our squadron. And he and H.R. McMaster, who was the commander of the Eagle Troop that I was assigned to, were brilliant at tactical. I mean, they had us prepared for everything. We studied the Gazala battles in North Africa during World War II with the 10th Panzer Army, or the Panzer Army Africa, and what the British did, you know, how things worked and how they didn't work. Then we physically trained everything in the Saudi desert in large-scale operations so that when it came time to operations, we knew exactly what the enemy was going to do. We knew what we were going to do because we had been trained on failures and the things that were done right in the past. So I just have a hard time understanding how people whose lives are on the line still do this stuff today.
Well, you put your finger on it. Leadership. It's leadership. And because it's in the CIA, and not in the Army, because at least in the Army, there was some measure of accountability. But I saw too often within the CIA where, politics and other issues intrude. I mean, I give one very simple example. When Congress restarted the funding for the Contras that were in Honduras, then the chief of base that was in Honduras was told, get those Contras moving into Nicaragua. Well, but he said, they're not armed. They don't have weapons yet. We don't care. Congress has approved the money. They've got to get moving in. And what they did is they told these guys, you're not getting any more food. If you want food, you got to cross the border into Nicaragua and you get fed there. We'll airdrop you the food. And so I'm sitting as an analyst and we're watching this infiltration. I didn't know that part of the story yet. And we're watching these Contra units going in and they're getting chewed up by Sandinista battalions. And we're going, geez, they're not very good at fighting. Well, yeah, if you don't have guns and ammunition, you aren't going to be very good at fighting. So, I mean, that's just one small example I've seen, but I've seen that at the CIA. And so when you tell me that you got CIA involvement with this, that explains it, because they do not, the accountability within the agency is almost non-existent. And it's more about, hey, well, we got to get these guys in. We got to get these guys out. And they may not necessarily think it through in the same way that, like, as Doug did with McMaster.
I just can't imagine at this stage how it's criminal negligence not to be able to see stuff like this.
Yeah. It's not the first.
Whether thing. American or Ukrainian, I don't know. It's just beyond me.
Not the first time.
I want to go a little bit further in here because I want to really expand on something you said a second ago on terms of what the Russian, I guess, operational art is. We are focusing on Pokrovsk here, and that's for an understandable reason. But as you said earlier in this show here, that's not the only thing the Russians are doing. And I saw this interview with Colonel Stanislav Krapivnik on the Duran.
And I thought he was a U.S. Army major.
Major. Okay. I thought he was a colonel.
No, not major.
But I knew he was a vet. But his explanation for what the Russians are doing elsewhere on the front and how this all leads together, I thought was really instructive. Watch this.
Yeah. The northern portion of Pokrovsk is fully surrounded. The southern portion, almost all of Pokrovsk, is now in Russian hands. About 80% of Pokrovsk is in Russian hands. About 20-30% of Mirograd is in Russian hands, which is east of Pokrovsk. But the Russian forces aren't in any hurry. They've got the guys surrounded. There is about a kilometer and a half wide corridor left. And that's swept by drones. God, I watched this video from actually the south of this cauldron. It was a 20-second video, and I counted 9 or 10 drones flying over in that 20-second video. I mean, you want to talk about a target-rich environment. There is no reason, arrows are cheaper than men. Well, in this case, drones are even cheaper. Much cheaper than men. Why clear the enemy out when you can just exterminate them and then come in and pick up whoever's left, either alive surrendering or pick them off as you need to. The Russian army's been doing that as it was, because every time it advances and it hits an obstacle, hard enough obstacle, they usually step back and just start hammering it with everything they have. Artillery, drones, direct fire from tanks. Tanks are still there. You don't see the big tank advances right now, but the tanks are still there. They're just being used as direct fire weapon systems, platforms. And you don't need modern tanks for that. That's why, the West is celebrating, oh, look, T-72s, T-64s are being moved in. They're talking about T-55s. Yeah, and they work, because they're serving an entirely different purpose in this case. They're doing infantry support as direct fire weapons.
So he put a little bit more meat on the bones of what you described, that they're not in a hurry. And they are prioritizing firepower over any risk to their troops. Do you see right. that happening across the front, or just right here in Pokrovsk?
No, it's across the front. Simplicius the Thinker put out a good piece earlier this week where he talked about how, particularly with respect to drones, it's changed the entire concept, the traditional concept of maneuver warfare, that in terms of being able to mass forces and and then have them move from point A to point B in order to flank entrenched units, because the drones are so ubiquitous and capable of striking not just on the what is traditionally considered the front line, but actually in depth, going back, you know, 10, 20 miles, and sometimes more. So it's forced the Russians and the Ukrainians to change tactics. So, you know, the Russians aren't massing troops to rush into an area. They're doing more small man units, but they're increasingly reliant upon drones, because it's like, why put a human being at risk when you can do it with a drone? And it's and Russia's production of drones has now accelerated dramatically. I mean, they put it on an industrial scale. They're producing on an industrial scale. They're outproducing all of NATO. Think about this: all of NATO by about 3 to 1. So, you know, we can't compete with drones. We can't compete with artillery shells. We can't compete with
manpower,
tanks. You know, it's just there's not a single area you can point to where you could argue that Ukraine and or NATO have an advantage over Russia with either personnel or weapon systems. You know, if I challenge anybody, come up with that area where they do have an advantage. It just doesn't exist.
And so
Russia is maybe they were slow to sort of wake up, but man, once they get on the horse, they're riding hard.
And we got a history of that.
Yeah.
Now, I titled this the Ukrainian European self-delusion condemns Pokrovsk, right? That's where we started off this.
Right.
And we just physically showed both with the major, good major there, about his talking about what's physically going on inside there. We've shown you the map, et cetera. Unfortunately, we've also talked about an example with this, you know, so-called special forces slaughter that we sent to their death. But there is also the delusionary part, self-delusion. So if you just look at the facts and then all of those fundamentals you just mentioned about the domination and the amount of ammunition you can produce, the drones, the manpower, all those kind of things, any rational person, and I mean any rational person, would say it is suicidal to continue fighting this battle. Unfortunately, that's where we are on our side of the line. Here is, and I hate to do this to you, I don't want to ruin your day this early, but here is Brother Jack Keane talking about how, as it turns out, Russia is not winning after all.
Russia advertises every day that they're winning the war, and they are not winning the war. I laid that out in a New York Post editorial last week, the details of all of that and what that really means. In 2025, they're averaging over 1,000 casualties a day.
Wow.
And all the territory that they've taken is 0.6% additional territory. In the last 2 years, they've been trying to conduct this offensive to take all of southern Ukraine, which by anybody's characterization has failed, despite Russia saying they're advancing every day and making progress and winning the war. They've only gained 1%. They haven't taken a major city since 2022. When they took Mariupol. So this is a Russian narrative. We have a tendency to buy into it, and it's actually exaggerated and quite false.
So they have, I'm sorry, I got to go back to the map. I just couldn't resist. It turns out that Russia hasn't taken anything since Mariupol in 2020. Oh, hang on a second. Mariupol's way the heck back here. Is it that let's see, where is Mariupol? It's down south, right here. So there's kind of a few cities in between here and there. So I think maybe there's something, this place called, I don't know, you may have heard of it, Bakhmut, Severodonetsk, Lysychansk. I mean, you can just keep on going down the list here.
Avdiivka.
Kind of some big ones here. And here, probably in a week or two, Pokrovsk, you can add that probably to the list. Toretsk. I mean, just what is he talking about, man?
Yeah. Well, he's a creature of the Institute for the Study of War, which is one of the greatest oxymorons surrounding Washington, D.C. They also like to use this percentage of territory taken because they compare the entire territory of Ukraine. But just do the comparison with the territory that's to the east of the Dnieper River. All of a sudden, you get a very, very different picture. But, you know, this kind of happy talk and denial, you know, in the future, when you look up the name Jack Keane, it will be seen as a synonym for Baghdad Bob, you know, because he's doing the same kind of thing. And you know, it's sad. I don't think Keane is a stupid person. You know, I don't think he's got mental handicaps. So you really have to step back and just ask, is he just so blinded by ideology that he's incapable of recognizing what the Russians are doing? That, you know, this is one of the biggest differences I saw, and not just the conversation with Aludinov and with Brzezinski and, you know, several others, and a war correspondent named Sladkov. Whenever I asked him about the U.S. military, NATO military, they spoke respectfully of the West. They didn't demean them, insult them, call them names, make fun of them, that they're weak, that they're stupid, it was always, you know, we respect that they're a formidable enemy that we have to take seriously. That was their attitude. Whereas with the likes of Keane and Hodges and Petraeus and Stavridis and, you know, go down the Kimmich, you know, they all have got this, those Russians, they stink. They're terrible. They're stupid. They're weak. They're incompetent. That's called underestimating your enemy. And, you know, I think it's always a better strategy to overestimate their competence and to be pleasantly surprised that they're not as good as you thought they were, as opposed to saying, oh, they're no good, and then they end up kicking your ass, which is what's happening right now. Because, you know, as I pointed out, on every single weapon system, Russia has hypersonic missiles, four, five of them, different types. The West doesn't have a single one, not one that's been fielded and operationally employed. Modern battle tanks, Russia's producing between 60 to 80 in 2024. The entirety of NATO didn't produce a single one. The ones that were being produced were upgrades being refurbished. Well, the Russians are doing that too, and they're producing more refurbished tanks than the West is. The country that produced tanks and sold them to Poland was South Korea. So, you know, South Korea is not part of NATO, last I checked. Artillery. The Russians enjoy a 3 to 4 to 1 advantage in production of artillery shells. Drones. They enjoy a 2 to 3 times advantage. So, I mean, it's just weapon system, weapon system, weapon system. Air power, they've got the decided advantage on air power with the glide bombs. What are these?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, and like with all this, whether it's the Garand, they now have new Garand 3 with the jet engine. They have these glide bombs that are now some of the variants are supersonic. They can go up to 200 kilometers instead of like the 50 and 70 and 100 that they did earlier, et cetera. I mean, all even the drones, I mean, really everywhere, it continues to escalate and evolve in capacity as much as in quantity as well. And yet, and I, again, I'm sorry, I hate to do this to you, but you mentioned Hodges. And, well, we have one of those, too.
Okay. Torture me.
I believe the administration's approach has been doomed to failure from the start. They have never understood or even cared about the origin of the conflict, the causes of the war, the geography, or the history. He won't even say that Russia is the aggressor, and he has never told President Putin, get your troops out of Ukraine. Instead, they talk about Ukraine needing to give up land for the sake of peace.
There's a lot of problems there. But one of the things that I did a double take when I first watched this and literally backed it up. And I said, wait, did he just say that the United States and Trump especially doesn't understand the history of this, what led to the war, and that how dare we not say that Russia was the sole aggressor? I think he might want to re-examine his history.
Yeah. The fact of the matter is that the United States, with other NATO allies, has been engaged in an effort that goes back to 1995 in terms of trying to build up and use Ukraine. In fact, you know, Ukraine played a significant role with the CIA after 9/11 in terms of being a place where people could be tortured. You know, suspects were taken there, and you know, the Ukrainians happily provided a place where the United States could do illegal things.
Didn't know that.
Yeah, so this is the Russians might have pushed back against the West earlier if they had had the military strength, but they waited and they built up. And then it was in 2022 after the peace proposal put forward by Putin was rejected. You know, and we already know that the two Minsk agreements were just charades by the West. And you have François Hollande, the president, then president of France, and Angela Merkel, who's the German chancellor, they both admitted, you know, all it was a guise to buy time for Ukraine. So, you know, it's sad that people, again, like Hodges, Petraeus, Keane, all these groups, they are they're really a disgraced group of men because they presided over failures of the U.S. military.
Larry, there's a couple of things in particular, aside from what I've already mentioned, and that soundbite from Hodges right there, that trouble me more than it may seem on the surface of it. Because one of two things may be in place here. One is that either men like Hodges, they genuinely don't understand how things work, or the alternative is that they do understand and they're saying things that might make a civilian audience believe something, but they themselves know isn't true, but they're saying it anyway for some other nefarious reason. I'm not sure which of those is worse, yeah. But let's take a look at what I mean when I say that. First of all, he says he was upset because Trump hasn't told Putin to take his troops out of Ukraine, because he implies that we have the capacity, the power, and the authority to just tell Putin to get them out. And so the fact that Trump hasn't done that is a problem for Trump and a failure of his to just say something, because he can do it if he would just tell him. What do you make of that?
Yeah, and I wrote a piece about last week. The U.S. has no leverage over Russia. Zero leverage. There's nothing that the United States builds, makes, produces that Russia needs. And they don't need the U.S. dollar either. Russia would prefer to have a good relationship with the United States and with Europe. But they're not going to do it by sacrificing their own security. And what they've seen, and you know, it really took a dark turn this week when Trump announced that the United States was going to start testing nuclear weapons again. The Russians said, all right, this is Putin directed the Russian general staff and the minister of defense. Let's get cracking. Because Russia hasn't actually tested a nuclear weapon since 1996,
I think. Somebody else was 96.
It was under the Soviets. So the Russians themselves,
Russian Federation has never tested one, Yeah.
Now Russia has deployed these remarkable weapon systems and platforms. You know, the Berezhnik this week, as well as the Poseidon, or a week ago that they finally revealed, the Oreshnik missile that was unveiled last year. So. You know, Russia really sits at a decided advantage over the United States technologically. We don't like to admit that, but it is a reality. However, Russia, it looks like the window of goodwill between Moscow and D.C., it's now dead. And Moscow is going, they're going to press forward. This war in Ukraine, you know, Russians still characterize it as a special military operation because they have not mobilized Russian society for war, which they very well could do at some point. But nonetheless, they recognize they're winning. They're going to continue moving forward. They will take Dnipropetrovsk. They'll take Kharkiv. They'll take Sumy. They'll take Poltava. It may take another year or two. Again, they're not on the clock. Their economy is not suffering because of that. You know, there's some in the West arguing, oh, yeah, the war has really devastated their economy. No, the slowdown in economic growth came because of a deliberate policy by the central banker, Nabulina, to slow the inflation. And she's achieved that. And so they expect to have the economy continue to grow in 2026.
But, and I'm sorry, Larry, we're running a little low on time today, and I want to get a couple of other things in that I want to ask you about. Is that the other thing that Hodges said here, which may be one of the most important issues of, I think, self-delusion that there is, he basically mocked the idea that Ukraine should give up land for peace,
no,
because implying that there is a simple choice to be made. We can just say, no, we don't want to do that because we don't want to and we don't have to. What do you say to that?
Yeah, Russia's made it clear. Putin made it clear on June 14th, 2024, that Crimea, Kherson, Zaporizhia, Donetsk, Luhansk, those are now permanent parts of the Russian Federation. They're not giving that back. That is Russian territory. The people who live there are citizens of Russia. The Ukrainians are going to be, they can leave voluntarily. They can leave under a negotiated settlement, or they're going to be killed or captured. But they're going to be removed one way or the other. And in the process, Russia has now made it clear that they will expand their military operations into Dnipropetrovsk, into Poltava, into Sumy, and into Kiev, and into Odessa. They'll capture those, and then they'll hold an election. They'll give the people a choice. Do you want to stay part of Ukraine, or you want to become part of the Russian Federation? And if the people in those territories vote to become part of the Russian Federation, Russia's going to expand. That's where this is headed. There is no negotiated settlement on the horizon. Ain't going to happen.
And there was. I mean, you can go back to June of 2024. There was one. You can go back to Alaska. There was one on the table. It was ugly, and the longer it's gone, the uglier it's gotten. But Larry, if we don't take the ugly deal, I think your description there, all the way to Poltava, maybe all the way up to Kiev, certainly down to Odessa, down to Transnistria. I don't see anything that can stop the Russians other than their conscious decision.
Right. And, you know, one of the other points that Stas Karpivnik made in his chat with the boys at the Duran was once Russia reaches the east bank of the Dnieper River, that's it for the Ukrainian economy, because Russia will then effectively control that waterway, or at least it will be contested. And that waterway has been an important source for transporting grain and other products down the river into the Black Sea port. And that, you know, that's going to come to an end. And so then the Ukrainian economy, it's a basket case right now. It will be potentially non-existent. So, you know, the Russians they're not getting emotional. They are getting more determined that, you know, they've had enough of the deception of the West, the lies of the West, because they understand that right now those HIMARS crews that are firing missiles into Russia, those are staffed by U.S. soldiers, not staffed by Ukrainians, and that's why the potential of deploying Tomahawks I encountered a lot of concern about that, not fear. But it was more that, look, if that happens, we've got to assume those are carrying nuclear warheads, and we're going to have to react accordingly. And, yeah, you know,
that's no good for nobody.
You know, Trump had a conversation with Putin, I think, about 10 days ago. And I think what Putin told him at the time was, you know, Don, buddy, if you deploy these Tomahawks, we have no way of knowing that they're not carrying a nuclear warhead. And we're going to have to assume that. And so if any of them are fired at us, into Moscow or into St. Petersburg or deeper into Russia. We're going to have to retaliate, and the retaliation will include the United States, the continental United States. You need to understand that. That's where we are with this.
And it's ironic because Jack Keane, in that same interview I'd had that excerpt from, he argued again that Trump needs to give them the Tomahawks, and that once they have them, they need to attack the Garen drone factories that are very, very far deep into Russia. Mm-hmm. And that'll teach Russia a lesson. What do you think would happen if that was actually carried through and those facilities were blown up?
Yeah, NATO facilities throughout Europe would be targeted and destroyed with the Oreshnik missile. And there's nothing the West could do to stop it. It was interesting that after that conversation with Putin, Trump came out and said, yeah, no Tomahawks for Ukraine. I don't think that was just a coincidence.
Trump is famously for changing his mind. Let's hope that's not one of them.
Yeah,
let's hope that remains off the table permanently. But we'll see what happens with the rest of that, and we'll also continue to track what happens here. Thank you so much for coming on today and giving us this layout here. The uncompromised truth about what's going on. That's one of the reasons we so appreciate you coming on. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Danny.
And we thank you guys too, and let you know that actually we have another show literally in just 10 minutes from now, a little over 10 minutes, what Russia's true war objectives are. And we're going to have Commodore Steve Jeremy from the UK going to be on with us today. That's going to give us some additional insights. We're going to take some of the things that Larry had talked about here, but we're going to expand on those from some additional sources. You're not going to want to miss that. I promise you. We will see you shortly in about 10 minutes on the Daniel Davis Deep Dive.